and my falsity had stung me like a hornet. The poison sank and it paralyzed my will. I could not move to warn all the younger soldiers that they had been deserted from above.
Joining us now is Joby Warrick, who is the author of the new book, The Triple Agent, the Al-Qaeda mole who infiltrated the CIA. He covers national security for The Washington Post, where he's been a reporter since 1996. He won the Pulitzer Prize for a series called Boss Hogs, which documented the political environmental fallout caused by factory farming in the Southeast. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joby Warrick.
Hey, thanks for having me here.
And your story comes from the December 2009 incident at Coast, the base near the Pakistan-Afghan border. I believe it was originally a Soviet base, then it was a Special Forces base. But I remember when it happened, I thought, my God, there's got to be a story here. How did this happen? And you've done that in this brand new book, The Triple Agent, the Al-Qaeda mole who infiltrated the CIA. Let's just go back, I guess, to how he was recruited by the Jordanian Mukhabarat. In your book, you mentioned Joby Warrick, how when his father, Halil al-Balawi, was told of his son's death, he said that when he was at the beginning of 2009, when he was arrested and detained for 3 days by the Mukhabarat, then he was released, and there was clearly a severe change came over him. It is this, he wrote, that caused me to lose my son. What happened in those 3 days?
It's a remarkable beginning, you know, of this incredible journey that starts really with a man who's a pediatrician. He's a father with two kids living in Amman, Jordan, which is a relatively modern Arab city. And he ends up being, you know, the most unlikely spy, really, that you could possibly imagine. But here's a guy who has a dangerous habit on his side. He's living a quiet life superficially, but he's writing these terrible internet blogs, you know, railing against the West, railing against Israel, inciting young Muslims to violence. But the Jordanians figure out who he is, and they arrest him, they interrogate him, they put him in this prison for 3 days, and don't exactly brutalize him, but just make very clear to him that his life's going to change forever, and he has to straighten up and become one of them, or else there's going to be all kinds of trouble. And here's the guy, he wasn't a terrorist, he wasn't some hardened criminal, and he actually flipped pretty quickly, and after, you know, just a couple of days in their clutches, decides, sure, okay, I'm going to renounce my past, I'm going to be your guy from now on. That's how it all begins.
But surely, given the history of the father, given that the father came out of Palestine in the partition, lost everything, and the son grew up one of what, 10 children in a refugee camp. I mean, my understanding is that those places are kind of petri dishes for festering hatred, particularly of Israel and the West.
Yes, it's sort of a family hobby, I think, to sit around, you know, the family dinner table and talk about their bad luck and about the horrible things that have happened to them as a, just not only as a family, but as a group. And this young man, Humam, grew up in this environment, and they ended up being sort of kicked out not only from what is now Israel, but they moved briefly to Kuwait and got kicked out of that place after the first Iraq invasion. And so they've had all this hard luck. It's a sort of angry household, and all these feelings are transferred to a very angry young man. And not a stupid man, but one who's very bright, who understands the West, and has a lot of hostility toward us.
And he marries a Turkish wife, who's a journalist for a conservative Istanbul newspaper, who later translated a biography of Osama bin Laden into Turkish. What was her role in the radicalization? Although, you know, again, we don't... I suppose we have to assume in retrospect that when the Muhabarat flipped him, they didn't really flip him.
No, although at the time, there were all appearances that he had gone the other way. But yeah, he had a pretty interesting partner in his wife, who was at least as ideological and at least as angry as he was for different reasons. And as you mentioned, she was very much into the Osama bin Laden story. The book that she translated from Arabic into Turkish was Osama bin Laden, the Che Guevara of the East. So she sort of lionized this guy, and he was a hero to her. And it's just an indication of how the couple felt when they had children. Their first daughter was named after a Palestinian hijacker. Then they had a second child, and they named her after a documentary filmmaker who made a film about the hijacker. So just a little flavor of how they, you know, what they talked about in their house.
Again, I'm speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Joby Warrick, author of the new book, The Triple Agent, The Al-Qaeda Mole Who Infiltrated the CIA. Now, the case officer, who is a cousin of Jordan's king, Ali bin Zayed?
Zayed.
My understanding is that the Muhabarat have always pretty much been subsidized by the CIA. So irrational exuberance, to quote Alan Greenspan, on their part? Were they so anxious to find a way to curry favor with the CIA? What do you ascribe their eagerness to offer this guy up as a double agent?
Yeah, you're right about the relationship. It's very close. The United States gives the Jordanian government a lot of money, and many people will say that the Jordanian intelligence agency is owned by the CIA. It's a little more complicated than that. They're actually quite good in their own right. We use them, we rely on them all the time, because the Jordanians are quite good at human intelligence, at running agents and informants, and that's something that the CIA has historically not been so good at. So we use them in all kinds of places in the world, and it's sometimes a relationship that has to be hidden or seldom discussed for political reasons, because it's not very popular in Jordan to say that we're kind of they're lackeys of the U.S., but they do quite a bit of work for us. And they would like to, you know, to have us, have the CIA, believe that they're quite effective. And so when they find someone like this, they find someone who's potentially of use to the United States, they're very happy to hold them up and say, look, here's what we've done for you. And, you know, you can take over this case now. It's what happened here. The Jordanian said to the CIA, we've recruited this guy, now he's yours. And the CIA handled him in Pakistan, and from the moment he arrived, he was essentially a CIA informant.
So how did he establish his bona fides with the CIA? My understanding from your book, Joby Warrick, the triple agent, the Al-Qaeda mole who infiltrated the CIA, is that he was able to work with Al-Qaeda, in effect, to fabricate a video, which then convinced the CIA that this Jordanian had penetrated Al-Qaeda.
And that's really an extraordinary reflection on the man himself, because here's someone, if you think about him, has no training as an agent of any kind, and he doesn't even speak the local language. He speaks Arabic and English. He gets dropped into Pashtun country in the tribal area of Pakistan, and sort of sink or swim. You know, find your own contacts. You know, try to do what you can, but without much help. And everybody looking at this man when he arrives, he's a Jordanian. That makes him suspect initially. Just sort of an odd character to be walking around this very remote area. And there was every expectation the guy would probably be seen as a spy and maybe executed. But instead, he's able to convince the Taliban initially, and later on, Al-Qaeda itself, that he's on their side. So he's having to walk this line between these, you know, two very, very different worlds, and managed to convince both of them that he was legitimate.
So he, and of course, he's in Haqqani territory there, right? In Khost, which is on the Afghanistan-Pakistan border, and one of the things that I learned from your book, Joby Warrick, is that after the U.S. invasion following 9/11, when essentially the special forces entered Khost and took it over, and then they had a few skirmishes with the local tribesmen, there was a period there, even though Haqqani had helped bin Laden escape, he still was offering up his services because he'd worked for the CIA against the Soviets. And I take it that that many people think that the U.S. dropped the ball there, because we keep blaming the Pakistanis. We keep leaning on the Pakistanis who protect Haqqani. But we could have had him, right?
Haqqani is a warlord. He's out for Haqqani, and he runs that portion, or at least at the time he ran that portion of Afghanistan by the border. And in fact, if you go to the city of Khost today, there's one really striking, beautiful building. It's this large mosque with this great turquoise dome. And this is Haqqani's mosque. He built it for the city. Essentially, this is his property, his tribesmen. And he was perfectly willing, according to both CIA and Pakistani sources, to go with the U.S. side. He wasn't really a Taliban sympathizer. He went along with them for a few years just because it sort of had to be done to do business over there. But the overture to him was, okay, we'll let you come on our side, but you have to put on an orange jumpsuit and go hang out at Guantanamo Bay for a while. And, of course, he wasn't willing to do that, and so he became our enemy, and he continues to fight and kill Americans till this day.
So, Joby Warrick, again, the author of the new book, The Triple Agent, the Al-Qaeda Mole Who Infiltrated the CIA. So here we have this Jordanian operating ostensibly for the CIA, who have this base in the coast, a former Soviet base, then a special forces base. The woman that heads it up, Jennifer Matthews, has a young assistant, Elizabeth Hansen, and they're running this guy who, I guess, as soon as he meets with the Taliban, signs up with them. Then he manages to convince the CIA that he's infiltrating Al Qaeda. What are the role? I mean, he clearly had a connection here with Massoud, both particularly the surviving one that took over after the CIA predator had killed Baitullah Massoud.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So walk us through that, because I want to build up, as the book does, to the moment where the suicide vest bomb, 30 pounds of C4 with hundreds and hundreds of pellets, explodes and kills seven CIA officers. But just before we get to that, I want to be able to set the groundwork as your book does.
Yeah. Massouds are the leaders of the Taliban in Pakistan, and a man named Baitullah Massoud, if I can draw a portrait of him, he's a very short, stocky man, probably about 5'2", with this big, ragged black beard, was sort of a gun runner, a smuggler, a thug, but he ends up becoming the commander of the Taliban in Pakistan. And this is the man that our triple agent, Humam Balawi, ends up taking up with, staying in his house, eating at his dinner table. Massoud instinctively trusts him, and so he asks him to come join us, come to our training camp, come live with us, and Balawi readily does that. Well, it turns out that the CIA is very interested in Massoud for a number of reasons, one of which they think he has a dirty bomb they'd like to blow up in a Western city, and so they're looking for this man too, and as the book unfolds, they find him in August of 2009, and target him while he's getting his legs massaged by his wife on the roof of his house, and hit him with a drone strike. And from that moment, all kinds of new elements are brought into this storyline, including the fact that the Taliban now, the Massoud clan, are just determined to get revenge on the CIA for killing this leader of theirs, and they see Balawi as potentially a way to do that.
But Balawi himself didn't tip off the predators. My understanding is that they paid off the father-in-law, whose daughter, by the way, was killed, giving him the leg massage. Is that right?
Exactly. Yes. So Balawi was sort of innocent in that particular episode. He didn't tip off the CIA to Massoud's presence. But later on, after this takes place, as he's beginning to demonstrate his bona fides to the CIA, he is involved in some of the targeting for drone strikes and helps the CIA do their sort of bomb damage assessment, determining who was killed and what kind of follow-up action they need to do.
So then, Joby Warrick, take us through now to the climax here, where you've got Jennifer Matthews, who worked under Michael Scheuer, who I've spoken to a number of times, and obviously she's dogged in her hunt for Al-Qaeda, and there's this possibility that the Jordanian is the key, and this young woman as well, Elizabeth Hansen. How much were they blinding themselves?
They were extremely interested in what this man had, you know, had potentially to bring to them, and he promised, you know, not only to help them with drone strikes, but he was going to be able to deliver Ayman al-Zawahiri, the number two Al-Qaeda leader, and it had physical, incontrovertible evidence that he'd been in the presence of this man and other Al-Qaeda leaders. So when he comes to the CIA and says, I can deliver these people to you, everyone takes it very seriously because he has proof on top of his claims. And so it becomes imperative for the CIA to set up a meeting with this guy because no one had ever met him. He was, you know, one of the most exciting, electrifying agents in the CIA's employ, but no one had ever laid eyes on him. So it became extremely important to try to set up a meeting in a controlled environment so they could bring the guy in, look at him, check him out, and just see, you know, is he really telling the truth, or is he bluffing? Is he a con artist? You know, whatever, we have to find this out. So much effort and planning is put into setting up this pivotal meeting when the CIA is going to confront this man for the first time.
Well, but the fact, if the Jordanians are the ones that are case officers, even though there was a CIA case officer assigned to him, I don't understand why, if he hadn't been totally vetted and if there were still doubts about him, why did they expose themselves in such a way that they all were killed?
It, you know, as some of the agency officers who planned this meeting told me later, that this, it's like the 9/11 attack when, you know, there's all kinds of warning flags that were raised that look obvious in hindsight. But for everyone at the time, you know, the potential benefit of being able to capture or kill senior Al-Qaeda leaders was so alluring that all these other warnings were dismissed or downgraded or not emphasized. And they also, I think there had never been a case where an informant had lured CIA officers into a room and then blown himself up and killed himself. This had never happened before, so no one was looking for it. Instead, they were going out of the way to try to make this guy comfortable, to try to create a safe, secure environment for him, even baked him a cake because it had been his birthday a few days before that. All attention paid to making this guy feel very safe and protected when, in fact, he was intending to kill them the whole time.
Well, Joby Warrick, I thank you for joining us and for your new book, The Triple Agent, The Al-Qaeda Mole Who Infiltrated the CIA. We sort of barely scratched the surface of it. I just wanted to go through the story, which is told very dramatically, and it's a great read. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for your time.
Again, I've been speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Joby Warrick, the author of the new book, The Triple Agent, The Al-Qaeda Mole Who Infiltrated the CIA. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank producers Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available at ianmasters.com, where you can sign up for podcasts and contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by half.